One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Matea, reminding you that this show cannot be made without you. If you've been thinking about becoming a Canada Land supporter, we're having a pretty great sale right now. You'll get premium ad-free feeds of all Canada Land shows, discounts on merch from our store, and exclusive bonus episodes, like a behind-the-scenes tour of the federal budget lockup, more of Boris Johnson's trip to Canada, and of course, more of us yapping about what's hot in politics right now. We want to make it as easy as possible for you to become a Canada Land supporter. So from now until the end of May, we have a special offer for our listeners. Sign up now for just $2 a month for the next 6 months. Just go to canadaland.com/join or click the link in your show notes to become a supporter today.
Hey, it's Fatma Sayed, and this is The Backbench, a podcast about Canadian politics. This is our first weekly episode. We wanted to have more conversations with people who are impacting or being impacted by Canadian politics. To that end, today we take you to the United Nations, one of the main theaters of the global response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Canada's guy there is Bob Rae, former Ontario Premier, former Liberal leader and MP of Toronto Centre, and now Canada's UN Permanent Representative, or PR. For the past several weeks, Bob Rae has been Canada's voice on the international stage.
Canada's history and our proud association with all the people of Eastern Europe have led us to this point. We are partners in peace. We are partners in the quest for security and prosperity, and partners in the struggle for a world bound together by peaceful, friendly relations among nations and a common commitment to democracy and the rule of law.
The day this episode comes out, the president of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, will be speaking to our parliament in a special session since our parliament doesn't actually sit again until March 21st. President Zelensky has been doing a virtual speaking tour of many parliaments in the West to rally any support he can get for Ukrainian efforts to hold off the Russian invasion. Meanwhile, European leaders have denied fast-tracking Ukraine's membership into the European Union, but are considering bringing them into the fold somehow. We've talked about this a lot on the backbench. What is Canada's role in this ever-changing world? What should it be? And how do conversations on the international stage impact our decisions here at home? So I asked Bob Rae. He's been using some of the strongest language among Canadian leaders about this conflict. Over the weekend, he tweeted, quote, "The point is not just that Ukraine and the West are working together, that NATO is united. The point is that Putin must be defeated. Losing with dignity and integrity can't happen. The consequences of that are too serious." Those are very strong words, and I tried to understand Bob Rae's perspective and influence at home and abroad. Let's get into it.
Hello.
Hi, Bob. It's Fatima. How are you?
Hey, Fatima. How are you?
I'm good. Are you in New York?
No. Today I'm in Ottawa.
Amazing. Have you been traveling a lot?
No. I've been staying put in New York a lot.
That makes sense.
To the center of the epicenter of my activities over the last month or so.
It's been a while since we chatted, so thank you for doing this.
Pleasure.
So I wonder if I could start by asking you to walk us through what's happened after the Security Council called an emergency special session on Ukraine at the General Assembly. Can you just describe like the first moment this hit the United Nations?
Well, I think it's complicated in the sense that there's many different sources of information and chat. all the PRs, as we call ourselves, are on WhatsApp. So WhatsApp is sort of the one of the lines of communication that, you know, lights up very early in the morning and closes off very, very late at night. So in a country like Canada, we're not on the Security Council, as you may know. Mm-hmm. So as we're not on the Security Council, what happens is that we hear from others, and we have groups of friends that we talk to who we share information with. And normally what happens as well is that we have the two or three or four countries that we're close to that are on the Security Council. Usually the non-permanent members are the people that we kind of have a regular connection with and a debrief with as time goes on. Also, you should know that there's been a background conversation about what's been happening in eastern Ukraine for many, many years, since the Crimean crisis and even before. And that leads to a sharing of information with people on the Secretariat, with other sources about what is happening and what is the significance of the buildup. So that's sort of the what I would call, I guess, a bit about the architecture of discussion.
Well, can I ask, so you learned about this through one of the WhatsApp messages or through, you know, the news that you receive and follow. Was the United Nations or were you caught by surprise when this all happened?
No, I think it was kind of weird, actually. There was this weird event that happened where the Security Council was meeting in at night to continue the discussions about what more might or should be done. And it was clear that the Russian ambassador who was chairing the meeting had no idea that Putin was about to authorize the invasion.
What gave you that impression?
He was taken aback. Everybody that was there said that, you know, he didn't know that as he was speaking about what more could be done to achieve peace, that his boss was ordering an invasion. And this is not the only time this happens. I mean, the Japanese had an official delegation in Washington, D.C. in 1941 when Pearl Harbor happened. Mm-hmm. Now, did they know? No one knows. They left very quickly after that. There's lots of parallels for this, but it was an unusual circumstance. But it's also a reflection that when you're dealing with governments like the Russian government, clearly evidence of the isolation of Mr. Putin, and he was going to make the call. When he made the call, nobody would know when it would be, and that's what he did.
Mm. This brings up an interesting point about, you know, the relationship between someone in your position and the government and the country that you represent. And I wondered, can you describe for us what the relationship is like between you and the Prime Minister's office right now? Are you in constant contact? Are you advising them? Are they instructing you? What is the relationship there?
Well, it's actually, of course, I'm in constant contact both with the PMO as well as with my department, the Foreign Affairs Department, mm-hmm. and with officials there and also with people in the minister's office. Every conceivable line of communication is there in a variety of ways. We talk to each other all the time. That's normal. That's what you would expect to happen. Within parameters that are set by government policy, I'm encouraged to do the communications that I do.
Are you able to share what kind of advice you're giving them or what you're seeing at the United Nations that you're relaying to them that would make it pertinent for their policies and their approach in this crisis?
It's exactly what you would expect. My private advice is not much different from what I had to say in public. I mean, I think... and the Prime Minister has expressed that as well when in his trip that he's taking with a number of cabinet ministers to Eastern Europe. It's an ongoing dialogue with them and with other countries, mm-hmm. about what can be done, what more should be done. And I communicate that as directly with with governments as I possibly can. Understanding, of course, that I'm not actually a decision maker in the sense of I don't sit around the cabinet table. And so it's important for for me and for everyone else to understand that there are limits to what I can do other than give advice. That's what I do. I give advice to my government, and I give advice to my colleagues here at the UN, assessments as to what's going on. And it's not any different than, as I said, what you see in public is what I do.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're now over two weeks into this conflict. What are you seeing now that, like, you know, what's the advice that you're giving to your colleagues at the UN and the government based on how the situation is unfolding thus far and what you're seeing ahead with your expertise?
Well, I think a couple of things. I mean, again, this is not particularly dramatic or original with me, but I think what we're seeing is a few things. One is the Russian war objectives have not changed. They're not signaling in any consistent way a shift in their objective. They're lying a lot, and they lie a ton. So a whole lot of what they tell you is just nonsense, and it's a constant reminder of the best books you can read about what what's going on in the world today are written by George Orwell. Like, you just got to read Orwell to kind of understand this is the Russian government is a lying machine, and so all of its public statements have to be read in that context. Mm-hmm. And I think it's hard for people to sometimes accept that. They'll say, well, you know, this guy said this, the foreign minister said that. And I said, the foreign minister is lying. Like, why are we spending a lot of time giving him credit for something? He spent weeks and months before the invasion telling us the invasion wasn't going to happen. So why would we believe him? And I think, you know, this is just a side point, but my tendency to say things like that make me a little different from a number of my diplomatic colleagues.
Well, I was going to ask, like, are you getting instructions from the government to say the things that you're saying or to take the direction that you're taking, or is this all you?
No, I'm not getting instructions. Mm-hmm. I'm being allowed to say things as emphatically as I do. Within the framework of government policies.
Bob, over the years, I've heard a number of government ministers in Canada, you know, claim that Canada's losing clout on the world stage, especially after how we handled Afghanistan last year. And this is the most I've seen Canada step up in an international conflict in a long time. Why do you think that's the case? Why do you think Canada has stepped up so forcefully in its response to the Russian invasion in Ukraine?
I think it's pretty fundamental to our position as to who we are at the UN and in NATO and in our other relationships with European countries. You know, at the UN, we have been able to be as strong as we have been because what is happening is a classic, a horribly classic breach of all the rules. The Russians have thrown out the rule book. Mm. And that's what makes this so critically important that we have to deal with it.
My follow-up to that was going to be, do you think our action, our response to Ukraine has anything to do with helping Canada get a seat at the Security Council?
No, nothing. That's not likely to happen for a very long time for a whole variety of reasons, but basically because of the way the UN election system works. No, this has nothing to do with the Security Council. And I think one of the things that's happened, I would argue, is that the dysfunction of the Security Council has been made very clear to everybody. Mm. The Security Council is not a functioning unit. The fact of the matter is that the Russians vetoed the resolution that criticized Russia while they were chairing a meeting. I mean, it's just nuts, right? You chair a meeting and then you exercise. I mean, it's just a terrible abuse of power and abuse of the veto. So I think that's created a different dynamic around people looking at the Security Council reform again, Canada's been very active in that battle and very active in that conversation. So that's a very different situation.
Can you expand on this? Like, how have we been active on that?
Well, we're part of a group of countries that are interested in Security Council reform, making the council work better, more transparently, more democratically, more accountably. We'd like to get rid of the veto altogether. That's obviously a challenge because there are five countries that have vetoes and they can veto any change. So we know the rules of the game. But we're working hard with other countries to say the idea that you can use your veto without any reference to the law or to the charter or to anything else, just exercise your veto any way you want because you happen to be a permanent member of the United Nations is terrible. It's a terrible abuse of power in the context of an organization that is supposed to be based on the rule of law. Mm. And the principle of the rule of law is the law is always there. It's always guiding your conduct. And it's clear that in this case, there was no guidance of anybody's conduct except for the whim of one person, Vladimir Putin.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
You know, Bob, last time we talked, which was several years ago, it was about the Rohingya refugee crisis, and you were serving sort of as an ambassador for Canada there. There's been a lot of talk about the differing responses to refugee crises around the world without, you know, diminishing the need for response here in Ukraine. But from your perspective, how does the UN's response to Ukrainian refugees and Rohingya refugees compare?
That's a good question. I think I've been very troubled over the years by how we respond to different crises. Troubled in the sense of where do the cameras go? Where can you get access? How do you get information? Why is this issue more important than another issue? And there are a lot of explanations about geography. As I said, where cameras can go. Well, now cameras can go anywhere because of social media. But how does social media, able to impact and influence our responses? And, you know, what is the critical geography that's at stake? And what else might be at stake? Here you have a situation that's happening in Eastern Europe. It's happening next door to Russia. And the impacts are immediate and clear, and the consequences and costs of what is happening are immediate and clear. Some disputes happen in places that are more remote, from major media centers, major power centers, major focuses of interest that say this is of great strategic interest to us or not. And there are different responses. One of the purposes of the United Nations is to try to even that out. That is to say, make sure that we're paying attention to all these conflicts, that there is no conflict that is more important than another, other than on a scale of how serious it is and how drastic it is. But I think that there's a lot of all through this conversation and crisis and dialogue and decision making about Ukraine, I've had many meetings with people about other situations, meetings about Myanmar and the Rohingya, meetings about Afghanistan, meetings about Yemen, meetings about what's happening in other theaters of conflict, if you like, and always there's a sense in those conversations of how do we get our issue in the mix? And I keep saying by doing what you're doing and also by insisting that all the UN agencies have to pay attention to all the conflicts. Mm. So, yeah, there is, of course, everyone in media, not to be I don't like to be say too much about the media because I don't want to be seen as complaining about the media. It's not that. I think it's just that the media, we have trouble focusing on more than one thing at a time. And you know as well as I do that some things in the media get to the front of the page and other things don't get to the front of the page. And that's not good. And that's something we have to pay attention to. But the question of why some crises matter more than others is complicated. But it's also true to say that this will always be the case, that there will be arguments about why are we paying attention to this and not about that. I've learned more about what is called whataboutism at the UN than in any other place I've ever been. Because every time you mention something, somebody from another country will say, well, what about me? What about my situation? What about my crisis? You're not paying attention to this. And you have to say, yeah, I'm paying attention to it, but I'm actually paying attention to this one first because it's the most immediate and has the most potential for serious, serious consequences. If Russia was not a nuclear power, and if their leader had not, you know, and their leader has said, I am authorizing a heightened nuclear alert, that's going to get attention. Why? Because the consequences of that are so catastrophic.
Yeah, I mean, I think throughout this conversation, we've talked a little bit about the challenges and limitations that an institution like the United Nations faces. And I have thought about this a lot, too, over the last 2 weeks as a former model UN kid and someone who thinks deeply about international relations. But I wonder, is there a way for that institution, you know, who believes so strongly in democratic values and international rules-based order to become stronger after a crisis like this and, you know, deal with every conflict fairly and equally and have a stronger response, the kind that we've seen in Ukraine?
Yes, I think it can. I mean, I think it will have that effect on certainly people working inside the institution. And then there are a group of countries like Canada who believe very strongly in what the institution is trying to do and therefore are, you know, we are going to be contributing with, together with others, a conversation about, well, how do we move this forward in a consistent way? How do we up our game, knowing that the great powers, the United States and all the other permanent members, and many other countries that are great or aspiring to be great, have a different view of the UN, and they don't attach as much value to it as we do, because we rely that much more strongly on the multilateral system. Mm-hmm. And the reason we rely on the multilateral system is because we're a middle power. Mm-hmm. And if we didn't have a strong rules-based order, we'd be worse off. And because we don't have a system as strong as we'd like it to be, we are worse off. And, oh, by the way, so is the rest of the world. So are a lot of countries.
Bob, I know you're using the collective we to explain Canada's approach, but personally, as someone who's been at the United Nations for so long, who's dealt with multiple international conflicts, what have you learned in the past 2 weeks, and what are the challenges ahead for you?
I think the continuing challenge that I feel in my life all the time is some good and some not so good. One good is I actually can help in situations where you might say, well, what can I do? And you sort of say, well, now I'm in a position where I can actually do some things. I can talk to people. I can frame arguments. I can describe situations in ways that can move things a bit. And the longer I'm allowed to stay, the more contacts, the more people, the more persuasive I can be at a personal level. And don't worry, it's not going to my head. I was just saying this is something I can do and I can help. And it is that there's nothing better in life than to feel you've got a purpose and that you're making a constructive contribution. And it feels good. I mean, it's a nice way to feel. The tougher part is not just what we say, but also what we do. How much do we actually contribute? And I say we, I mean my country, Canada, and other governments that think like Canada and work like Canada. And so the continuing challenge is to make sure that what we do matches the words that we speak. And this is not novel to this situation, but it's very true. People, there's always this gap between what I call the dialogue of words and the dialogue of deeds. Mm. And if the deeds don't match the words, it's frustrating for the people who are hearing you, because they know you're saying things that they agree with, but they don't see the action that follows it. And that's always a challenge.
Well, I know the United Nations has often been criticized for being more rhetoric over action. Do you think after this conflict, it'll be stronger or weaker?
Well, I think the collective actions have been stronger by a number of countries, that it's the nation states that make these determinations, not the institution itself so much. The institution itself is actually not that big. And I think people often forget that. They think the United Nations, when people say the United Nations is a big world government, and you say, no, actually it's more like a municipal government. It's not a big institution. The Secretariat budget is smaller than the budget of the city of Toronto. So it's really the question of the institution itself, mm-hmm. how it can improve, how it functions. But it's also what can member states do to make a bigger difference.
Okay. And Bob, I've got one last question for you. Are we heading to an inevitable conflict where, countries like Canada will get involved militarily? Like, is this heading to an all-out war, do you think?
Oh, I can't speculate on that. I think it's really hard to speculate on that. I think what we know is we're living in a very uncertain time. And whenever you're in a war, it's easier to start a war than it is to stop a war. Mm-hmm. And it's not impossible for wars to escalate and for people doing things without fully understanding the consequences of what they're doing. And that's all very serious. That's something that we have to engage with. Mm-hmm.
Well, Bob, thank you so much. I always learn a lot when I speak to you, and I am very, very grateful that you gave us this time.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
Take care, Bob.
Take care.
Bye.
That was The Backbench. That was our first weekly episode. If you have any questions, concerns, rants, thoughts after hearing that, let us know. You can email us backbench@canadaland.com. We're also on Twitter @BackbenchCast. And if you're someone who's impacting or being impacted by Canadian politics, please get in touch. We want to have as many conversations as we can to put people back in politics. I'm Fatma Sayed, and you can find me on Twitter @FatmaBSayed. This episode was produced by Tiffany Lam with additional production by Tristan Capacchione. Our managing editor is Kieran Oudshorn. Theme music is by Nathan Burley. Thank you so much for listening. See y'all next week.
Hey, it's Matea, reminding you that this show cannot be made without you. If you've been thinking about becoming a Canada Land supporter, we're having a pretty great sale right now. You'll get premium ad-free feeds of all Canada Land shows, discounts on merch from our store, and exclusive bonus episodes, like a behind-the-scenes tour of the federal budget lockup, more of Boris Johnson's trip to Canada, and of course, more of us yapping about what's hot in politics right now. We want to make it as easy as possible for you to become a Canada Land supporter. So from now until the end of May, we have a special offer for our listeners. Sign up now for just $2 a month for the next 6 months. Just go to canadaland.com/join or click the link in your show notes to become a supporter today.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.